I guess I realized the archive number's not on here. Sorry about that. It was a bit of a fun project for me. I don't usually work on any topics related to exotic compact objects, alternative theories of gravity. In general, I'm a firm believer in GR as it stands, at least at energy scales, much less than the Planck scale. But I do at least have some sympathy for the idea that if you can test gravity, you should. And in this era of gravitational waves, we have an unprecedented opportunity to test gravity. And so if you can come up with a parameterized model for how you might get deviations from the predictions of gravity, it's well worth exploring that and trying to test that. So in this particular case, I'll be talking about this idea of echoes, which I'll introduce shortly. First, I want to talk about my collaborators. Zachary Mark is the first author on this paper. And he is a grad student at Caltech, so I really want to emphasize that he did the heavy lifting and computations. Yanbei Chen is his advisor, my former advisor, and we also had some discussions and assistance with Songmin Du. And so the four of us were the authors of this paper. So as motivation, I have to put a slide with a gravitational waveform on it. I think I'll do this for every talk, even if I'm giving a talk on something that has nothing to do with gravity, just because it's required. But the motivation here is to sort of get into...
Do you ever give talks that have nothing to do with gravity?
Well, I gave a talk on neutron stars once, so that was motivated by GR, but it was purely Newtonian gravity, so that was the furthest I've ever gotten from black holes. Right, so of course, what I'm really interested in is understanding the relativistic two-body problem, right, which is an incredibly challenging theoretical problem with far-reaching implications both for our understanding of gravity and also for predicting gravitational waveforms from compact objects. And so when you take two relativistic bodies and put them in a close orbit to each other, of course, the gravitational wave emission is appreciable, and they begin to lose energy to the gravitational waves, and their orbit shrinks. And over time, they continue to emit gravitational waves. The orbit shrinks, they emit more. You have this runaway in spiral where you get a gravitational waveform that oscillates, grows in amplitude, and also grows in frequency. Eventually, I'm going to be dealing with black holes here, so we'll focus on the black hole case. Eventually, the black holes get very close together, and you can't use approximate techniques to understand the evolution of the binary anymore. Instead, you really need fully numerical simulations of Einstein's equations in order to understand how the two black holes plunge together, merge into a final black hole, highly deformed object. But then it's really nice, shortly after this first contact, you can treat the system once again as highly deformed, as a large deformation from its final state, and you can treat this final piece of the in-spiral using these methods of black hole perturbation theory that I'll talk about. And this is known as the ring-down phase of the binary. It's characterized by exponentially decaying emission from this deformed final state. So, just in case some cosmologists or quantum information theorists snuck into this room, I put in some introductory slides about ring down and what are called quasi-neural modes. It seems like that was probably a good idea, because I think there are some people like that in the room. But I'll maybe go through some of the introductory slides a little quickly. But what is the idea of black hole ring down? Well, as I said, when two black holes merge, after the merger, you can treat the remnant as a strong perturbation from its final state. And these perturbations around the final state, they excite the resonant modes of the black hole. I'll discuss these resonant modes in a minute. These modes, which are then excited by the merger, they exponentially ring down at their characteristic frequencies and with a characteristic decay rate. And I'm just illustrating for Schwarzschild black hole a few of the overtones. There's a bunch of angular harmonics, and then at each angular harmonic, there's a fixed number of overtones. Each overtone decays progressively more quickly. And so often you just think about the lowest overtone, which is the least decaying mode. Okay, so it often sounds a bit strange to say that a black hole is ringing. After all, we know that nothing gets out of the horizon, at least not on a quick time scale, Hawking radiation maybe on a longer time scale. And so it's important to emphasize that this ringing, these modes, they are not a property of the horizon, or the black hole behind the horizon, they're a property of the whole space-time. So these modes really live near the horizon, but outside of it. And so in order to get an understanding of them, there's this nice heuristic picture. We first deal with short wavelength waves on a black hole, so just shining in, let's say, optical light around a black hole, in order to understand how a black hole can have these resonant states, okay? So if I shine a laser at a black hole, characteristically one of two things are going to happen. Either the laser beam has a high enough impact parameter that it just gets deflected by the curvature of the black hole, or it's got a low enough impact parameter and it gets absorbed by the horizon. There's a scattering picture when the wavelength of the waves that I'm shining in are not short compared to the curvature scale of the black hole. You really have to think about this in the wave picture. And in the wave picture, it's very similar. You have a scattering event, just like in ordinary quantum mechanics, like people dealt with in undergrad. You shine in some waves. The black hole itself presents some kind of scattering barrier, where the peak of the barrier is some short distance outside of the horizon, and the wave is partially reflected and partially transmitted down the horizon. Now, in between the two extremes of deflection and absorption, I can tune my impact parameter to be just so. And you can imagine that at just the right impact parameter, instead of deflecting or falling into the black hole, you'll be right in between those two extremes. And in that case, the laser light will circulate forever. And in fact, there is such an unstable orbit for light around a black hole. In the wave picture, this photon orbit, this unstable photon orbit, has an imprint. Okay, so there is a particular energy at which waves of a given angular momentum can be injected, in which they will sit here at the top of this potential. So now, in terms of the mode picture, let me see this. In terms of the mode picture, there's a particular set of resonances here where I don't actually have to shine in a wave in order for me to get transmission down into the hole and energy out. I can put waves that will sit here and transiently be trapped by the space-time as they gradually leak off. And in doing this, you can see that not just any frequency of wave will do for a given angular momentum, which determines the shape of the scattering potential, you need a very particular frequency to do this. And so by enforcing these boundary conditions that you solve the wave equation with outgoing boundary conditions on each side, you find that you get a discrete set of special frequencies known as the quasi-neural modes. These are the resonant spectrum of the black hole. So that's the picture in pictures, now the picture in math. I'm going to just deal with the scalar wave equation in this talk. It's a nice, simple system that gives all of the physical intuition and basic results without getting into some of the complications of dealing with electromagnetic or gravitational perturbations. So we'll deal with the scalar wave equation on a curved background. We'll have potentially some sources here. The way to solve this problem around a non-spinning black hole is you, of course, exploit the spherical symmetry and to separate your scalar field into spherical harmonics. And you also separate it in frequency so that you end up with some radio wave functions as well. If I plug this expansion into the wave equation in Schwarzschild, you find that the radio wave functions obey a very simple Schrodinger-like equation, which is why the scattering picture is the right way to imagine this. With one small detail, the relevant radial coordinate is no longer the Schwarzschild coordinate r, it's this tortoise coordinate that people here are going to be very familiar with that's infinitely stretched to the horizon. So the horizon sits at x equals minus infinity. Okay? So you have this region near the black hole from the perspective of the waves has been stretched out into a big region where the waves can freely propagate. As I said, if I set my boundary conditions now so that I solve the homogeneous wave equation with boundary conditions where waves are only going into the horizon or only leaving the space-time, that is an extra constraint, which means that only certain frequencies and decay rates will allow you to solve the homogeneous form of this equation. As I said, I'm going to talk about the scalar wave equation here only, but it's important to recognize that when you're dealing with gravitational waves, all of the pictures that I've been showing and all this math carry through directly. One of the great sets of discoveries over time has been that when dealing with gravitational waves or electromagnetic waves around black holes, you can write the equations in such a way that you're solving modified scalar wave equations. So you really solve for scalar quantities, and from these scalar quantities, which obey equations just like this, you can then reconstruct the gravitational field or the electromagnetic field as a second step. So everything boils down to scalar wave equations, some of them more complicated than this, but it's always scalar wave equations. And so you also get quasi-neural modes for gravitational waves and electromagnetic waves. OK, so that was.
Sorry, this is also true for a spinning black hole.
Yeah. So now for spinning black holes.
I mean, the fact that they're scalar.
Yes, yes. So that was this slide. So maybe I'm going too slow for Niyash. Sorry about that. I'm only going to be talking about Schwarzschild in this talk because it's simpler when we deal with this echo phenomenon I'm going to talk about shortly. But everything I just said, most of my work focuses on spinning black holes, where things are much more interesting. But the beautiful thing about the perturbation of gravitational waves or scalar fields or whatever around Kerr is that everything I just said transfers over with a few small modifications. For one thing, this picture I told you about with the photon orbits, that carries over as well, except the spin of the black hole now gives a splitting to these orbits. So orbits that are in the equatorial plane are closer to the black hole. Orbits that are inclined with respect to the spin are further away. And you have sort of a Zeeman splitting of the states. In the wave picture, that's exactly what's happening. Everything I just said holds, but now you can still separate the wave equations. It becomes a little bit more complicated, but you still separate the wave equations and get a radio wave function. But now these special frequency and decay rates, the quasi-neural modes, they also depend on the azimuthal quantum number. So they, in some sense, depend on the inclination of the wave. The mathematical story carries through. As I said, you can still expand these scalar wave equations in terms of angular and frequency modes. And with these modes, after solving simply scalar wave equations, it turns out you can reconstruct the metric, the electromagnetic field, whatever you want. So first you play with scalar waves, and then this step is not at all trivial. But it turns out that it can be done. And so at the end of the day, you can then cough out the metric perturbations. If you want a qualitative sense of what the spin does to the quasi-neural modes, simply put, as you spin up the black hole, the frequency of each of these resonant modes of the black hole goes up, and the decay rate goes down. Okay, so the faster the hole spins, the longer this ring down lasts, and the higher the frequency it occurs at. Okay, so the reason why the ring down is such an interesting piece of that binary in-spiral waveform I illustrated before is not that it contributes a particularly important part to, let's say, searching for and detecting these gravitational waves. It's a very short piece of the in-spiral. It's decaying away exponentially. What's interesting about the ring down is it has the potential to tell us a lot about that final state. It has the potential to give us some probes of what's going on with that final object that are unique to that final object. And in particular, people have talked for a long time about how you can use the quasi-neural modes to measure the mass and the spin of the black hole. So solving those wave equations with those boundary conditions, finding the spectrum of the black hole, this is a straightforward problem that's been solved for many decades. So it's understood how to calculate these frequencies and these quality factors in this case, but basically the decay rate, how to calculate them for any given harmonic, for the different m's, and for different spins of the black hole. So you can calculate these curves now. And if I were then to measure, in a gravitational wave event, oscillations at a particular frequency and at a particular decay rate, that maps uniquely onto a given mass and spin. The mass gives you the overall scale of the oscillations. And then the particular details vary with which mode you're observing and with the spin of the black hole. So if you were to measure both the frequency and the decay rate, you would be able to back out uniquely the mass and spin. Even more promising, if you were to measure two of these modes, you have a consistency test, because each mode gives you the mass and the spin. And so you can compare those two measurements and have a null test of GR. So this is something that people have talked about for a long time, doing with, let's say, LISA, where we expect to see supermassive black holes coalesce, have very, very loud ring downs that you observe very cleanly. And then you can use this as a test of GR. You can also do this, it turns out, amazingly, with not as high an SNR system as we expect to one day get with LISA, but in fact, one of the most amazing things about the very first detection of gravitational waves was that because it occurred, because the black holes that generated this gravitational wave were so high mass, this ring-down signal was actually firmly in the sensitive band of LIGO. Because this event was very loud, you could actually also do an analysis of it. And so for this particular event, and only for this particular event, LIGO was able to do an analysis and measure the frequency and decay rate only of the most important quasi-neural mode. So that would be the L equals 2, M equals 2 harmonic at the lowest overtone. And what they got was fully consistent with GR. It's a little bit complicated how to do this analysis, because basically, as I said, some time after the merger, you can treat the system using perturbation theory around the final state, but you don't quite know when that is, right? Because at merger, this is very nonlinear. So what you do is you cut the waveform at some late time, you use only the information forward of that, and you try to back out a frequency and a decay rate. Now, doing that becomes very inaccurate if you try to start very far after merger because the signal's very quiet. And so when you do this analysis, you get answers with gigantic error bounds. If you go earlier and earlier and earlier, you get a tighter constraint, but you also get biased eventually by the nonlinear effects. So if you go too early, you get the wrong answer because you're really probing the merger. But somewhere in between is the sweet spot, and it's completely consistent with GR. So this is the one and only measurement of ring down that's been done so far. Yeah?
When you say you match GR, this determines a mass.
Yes.
And an alternative theory could give a different mass.
Yes.
It's fit the data.
Yeah. So the way this is a null, the way this fits GR is the following. It's a little sophisticated. What you know is from the full waveform, you have a waveform model, which includes information from the in-spiral, from the merger, and from the ring down, and all of the information we know from simulating binary black holes. And it tells you, given this signal, what were the masses of the two holes that made the signal, and what final mass should they have generated, right? So you basically use the global information. Everything in the system points you to a unique mass and spin prediction. That's this black curve here. It's very tight because this was a well-measured gravitational wave signal. Just using the ring down alone can also give you the mass and spin, but it'll give you looser bounds. And in principle, if GR was wrong, these two measurements of the mass and spin don't have to agree at all, right? If something modifies the in-spiral but not the ring down, you could get a different prediction. So within the error bars here, this is basically a consistency test.
Spin too.
Yeah. You're also, this incorporates both mass and spin, yes.
But if you want to do a null test and you just use the part of the in spiral like, and cut out the merger?
That's also been done. So that's the second test that was done that's related to the ring down test is to, instead of cutting off the merger and in spiral, you cut somewhere before merger and you do a consistency test on those pieces. Basically, you should be able to cut anywhere and do a consistency test. The thing is that this particular consistency test, because you have enough signal after merger, you can specifically cut, and one part of this is specifically the ring down signal.
Right.
Yeah.
Other part they use to measure the parameters. Yeah. It seems like you can't include the ring down in that measurement.
It's not so clean to use the full information here as it would be to cut it, and so you can do that. For this particular measurement, this is more, in my opinion, kind of to illustrate that this is consistent with GR. This actually contains some information from the ring down, but because even in this well-measured system, the ring down was pretty quiet, a lot of the information in this black curve is not from the ring down, it's from the in-spiral and merger, right?
They have a plot before ring down and after the...
There's a different analysis where you actually cut. Here, yes, there could be in principle a cut, but I don't think they did that for this particular system.
That's a different app, but yeah. they have it here.
Yeah, there's an IMR, this is getting far afield, but there's another analysis where they split earlier, and they test in-spiral versus merger ring down. That can be done for more systems, because more systems have a strong merger ring down. So that was done for both GW150914 and the most recent event, GW17014. That consistency test. That's a different consistency test. Yeah.
You drop the mic.
Thank you. Okay. So we won't record the floor. We won't record the floor for the rest of the session. That was purposeful.
Let's say consistency. What level precision should we think of this as roughly being? Is there a clean answer to that or not really?
The cleaner answer comes from the other consistency test, the IMR consistency test. From this plot, it's not easy to say what that is, and off the top of my head, I can't say. But it would take fairly large deviations in the ring down frequencies to show up in this level of analysis. Like, you can see these error bars are factors of several in the decay rate, and factors of several in the frequency, not so much. The frequency's tighter, but you could modify the decay rate by a fair amount. Yeah. There's also a paper by Nico Yunus et al. Also analyzing the ring down from a different perspective and with not quite as precise an analysis, but that's a nice paper also to read about what this measurement means for alternatives to GR. Okay, so that was the introduction, mostly just to motivate you to, well, I love ring down, it's what I work on, so I gotta talk about it, but also to get us to this point, which is, what are these echoes and why are they interesting? So for a long time, people thought that seeing this ring down would be a smoking gun test that this is a black hole, right? If you see a ring down, it's a black hole, right? That's not actually true, and this was understood by authors in the past, but this entire subfield of echoes was reinvigorated by this paper, which followed the LIGO announcement by Cardozo, Franzen, and Pani, pointing out that, in fact, it's not true, that if you have an exotic alternative to a black hole, something that is not a black hole, it could be a boson star, it could be a gravistar, it could be some other wildly imaginative thing, so long as it's compact enough, you actually will still get a ring down. It won't be exactly the same ring down as a black hole, but it doesn't necessarily have to be very different than a black hole. Right? And so that was the message of this paper. Having a ring down doesn't guarantee a black hole, and the reason is, so long as the surface of the object is inside that photon orbit I talked about earlier, you still have a place to transiently trap energy, and the modes can still look sort of the same. But what they talked about was that these alternative spacetimes, whether you replace your black hole with a wormhole, I don't know what the empty shell is here, but this gravistar, right, is a shell surrounding some alternative metric inside. And what they did was they scattered in wave packets, and they measured the field at infinity. And you see the signal at infinity looks the same in all three cases. More so, underneath each of these lines is a black dashed line for a black hole of the same mass. It looks the same as those, right? At least this first event. But what they pointed out is that there's something they called echoes, right? Signals which happen at a later time and then sort of repeat but decay away over time. And these now are not present, obviously, in the black hole waveform, but do distinguish these alternatives, these other compact objects, from black holes. And since this paper, there's been a whole large number of papers. This is a subject that's kind of taking off. And so my collaborators and I looked into this and tried to see if we could say anything interesting about this subject. And so that's what I'll be talking about. I already sort of said this, but this is sort of the reason why you can still get a quasi-normal mode-like ringing when the object is not a black hole. So once again, in the black hole case, you have this scattering potential. This is roughly where the photons can orbit unstably. When you're talking about waves, this isn't quite the same place. It's the high frequency limit where this really gives you the photon orbit. But it's scattering off this piece of the potential that mimics the usual quasi-normal modes from a black hole. Other compact objects, like if I replace my black hole with a wormhole whose throat is near where the horizon would have been, this still has this scattering potential, and so you can still get the same effect. Similarly, if I have some kind of star-like exotic compact object, ECO, so that its surface is somewhere inside this photon orbit, once again, scattering off of this peak here can give you quasi-normal mode-like behavior, but the overall shape of the scattering potential is qualitatively very different. And importantly, one thing you expect is that this qualitative modification means that instead of having quasi-normal modes, each of these compact objects will instead have very long-lived modes. Right? So you can imagine you now can support a trapped mode here, which will only slowly leak out by tunneling. And instead of sitting here unstably at the peak of the potential, it can oscillate many, many times per E folding of leakage, right? And so what was long expected about these exotic compact objects was that their characteristic would be oscillations with a very slow time scale. So instead of seeing that, seeing these bursty echoes might be kind of surprising. But I'll get into why we see these bursty echoes. The characteristic then of the decay rate is some 1 over log of the position of the surface of the thing relative to where the black hole horizon would have been. So you can get very small decay rates by putting the surface very close to the black hole. Although even if you choose a Planck distance away from the black hole, because you then take the logarithm, it turns out that these decay rates are still not, you know, infinitely long. They're sort of astrophysically reasonable.
Decay rate is if R naught is large.
So things change qualitatively if R naught is large. If R naught is large enough that you no longer have this trapping region, you get rid of these modes entirely, and you might have different modes of the object, but you wouldn't have these sorts of modes, these long-lived modes. Okay, so now I can get on to my work. So the work I did with my collaborators was in building a parameterized model for all kinds of compact objects. So I talked about how these echoes were a qualitative prediction for many different objects. Well, it's useful then to have, instead of a model where object by object by object you have to study these things, you have an encompassing model which will tell you the echoes given some free parameters. And then you could test those parameters in principle, right? So we're going to focus on the scalar field case. We're going to focus on a spherically symmetric spacetime, so non-rotating. And in this situation, as I've already said, we've got the scattering potential of a black hole. And normally, when you've got a horizon out here, near the horizon, you basically have free propagation. You can have waves propagating back and forth, basically as like kind of like plane waves in this radial potential. So this is the radial wave function. It's just like plane waves in the Schrodinger equation. And then far from the black hole, you also have free propagation. When you have a very compact object here replacing this, you, of course, don't have this boundary condition that waves just go down a horizon and never come out. You have complicated boundary conditions set by the properties of the object, like, for instance, regularity of the perturbations at the origin. But it turns out, just from a very trivial calculation, that all I need to do is I can go ahead and set a barrier here at the surface of the object. And under the approximation that the waves are approximately freely traveling left-going and right-going waves here. That approximation is just saying that this surface is very close to the horizon of the black hole. Any boundary conditions I set for that compact object can be mimicked by simply having a frequency-dependent reflectivity here. So I completely replace every compact object that you could imagine with a position for its surface, which must be very close to the horizon, and a frequency-dependent reflectivity. Okay? And then, of course, for the purposes of our paper, we'll choose very simple reflectivities. The reality is that if you had your favorite model of a compact object, you'd need to go out and calculate what this reflectivity should be. And that might be hard, but at least now we have a parameterized model. One number and one function of one variable. Okay? So what we've done now is we're going to solve the scalar wave equation outside of a black hole, just like we've always done for black holes, except now instead of having a boundary condition where the waves go into the horizon, we have a boundary condition where waves get reflected back out at this location of the surface. Are there any questions about this model? Yeah.
Very close to the event.
So the primary approximation here is that the potential be nearly zero. Right, so the potential drops to zero at the horizon, and in these stretched coordinates, you have this long distance where the potential is basically flat, and so the waves propagate freely. The further out, the closer you take this surface to this potential, the more you're beginning to violate that. So the error in this approximation really depends on basically the value of the potential here, and for the purposes of many of the cases I'm going to be dealing with here, the value of this potential is infinitesimal at the location of the surface. But in one particular case I'm going to talk about, let's say you set R naught equals 3m. If R naught equals 3m, then this potential is only decayed away to about 25% of its value. And so the conclusions there may be more qualitative.
3m is
sorry, not 3m, sorry. Sorry, x equals 3, sorry. I'm thinking about these coordinates in my head, sorry. When r equals about 2.1, 2.1. That's the furthest out I'm going to take it. And if you take R further out than 2.1, you really just have to solve the system correctly. You'd have to modify the boundary conditions.
Can you do it numerically?
Yes. All these things can be done numerically. So the purpose of this model now is, as I'm going to show, once I have this model set up, it turns out that this gives you a way of quickly reprocessing predictions from black hole spacetimes into predictions from your favorite compact object spacetime. So you can now generate echoes in a parameterized way, given a single calculation that you do once and for all for what kind of source you're interested in the black hole case. And we learn some other things along the way.
Was purely absorbing, do you get any echoes? Or?
No, purely absorbing would be the black hole case. So the black hole limit is that everything goes into the horizon.
But do anybody have any models of exotic objects that aren't black holes, but yet they do absorb whatever this radiation is or not?
I think if we're talking about any kind of radiation, especially gravitational waves, I'm not talking about gravitational waves here, but let's say I was, the black hole would be the only object that could absorb all of that, right? Because gravitational waves interact so weakly, right? Yeah. So the only way to get perfect absorption would be that way.
Yeah. Electromagnetism, but that's not.
So yeah, so you could replace with a you could replace this with a conducting sphere for electromagnet, or not a conducting sphere. No, that would be terrible. I don't even know what you do. How do you absorb all the electromagnetic field? For at least for some things, you can imagine a really viscous ball that absorbs everything.
So
but
the fuzzball models of some, the problem is that none of these are really models, so you can say something that doesn't make it true. But I mean, the fuzzball models of some material, the idea there is that for energies big, much bigger than Hawking temperature, everything is absorbed. And for energies less than Hawking temperature, then things will be different, exactly what happens.
Of course, Mir basically thinks this is what a black hole is, so.
He says this is what the fuzzball is.
That's what he thinks black holes really
that's
are.
Right, yeah.
So,
right.
So we're going to be agnostic here and say that if you wanted to make this as absorbing as you wanted to, you could dial this down. But eventually, if you make this perfectly absorbing, it will look the same as a black hole for this model.
Yeah. Observation results. That claim there is a horizon or not depend on various assumptions.
Yes.
One of them is equilibrium. As much goes in as comes out.
Yes.
And so this, there's no observational evidence to date that there is a horizon for compact objects.
So that's kind of part of what motivates this, these studies, right? So for example, you might have said that the ring down was a signature that this was a black hole and therefore has a horizon. That turns out not to be quite true, right? You can get ring down like events, as I'm going to continue to show, without this object being a black hole. So you need, if you really wanted to show this as a horizon, you're going to need to use other methods. And I think the reality of the situation is that you can sort of make the thing arbitrarily close to a horizon in many different ways, and you can only put a bound on how similar this object is to a black hole. Of course, you might be able to put a bound that says this thing doesn't have a perfectly reflecting barrier a Planck distance away from the horizon. And that might be a pretty good argument for the fact that you'd want to choose this, you want to think of this as a black hole.
Just to check the formals that we're just doing. Linearized perturbation on a fixed background.
Yeah, so that's the other thing I need to really emphasize. This is black hole perturbation theory. So you're assuming that all these fields are test fields, all these particles are test particles. And in particular, if you imagine replacing this with an exotic compact object of some kind, if you really impinged waves on it, the material would also respond to that and move. So this is in the approximation where the material of the star also doesn't move, right? So these are really test fields. Good. This is just a note on our conventions. We use a non-standard convention when I'm going to be talking about the transmission and the reflection of the black hole spacetime. I'm going to actually be using the exact opposite convention people normally use. So for the purposes of our model, it's going to be important to understand how the potential barrier gives a scattering potential not to waves which are coming into the black hole spacetime, but waves which are bouncing off the reflecting barrier and then trying to make it back through the scattering potential of the spacetime. So if I shine a wave in from the left now, R of the black hole will be the reflection from this potential barrier, and T will be the transmission through this potential barrier. And then, as I've already said, we're setting up a second reflectivity here where these waves will bounce back off the surface of the object. So that we've got a cavity here, and so we need to talk about two different reflections and transmissions. So that might get confusing. If you get confused, please stop me and ask me. Okay. So the benefit now of our model of replacing the replacing the black hole by some reflected by the exotic compact object by some reflecting surface is that we can use all of our tools from perturbation theory around black holes, and in particular, we can build a green function to measure the response outside this black hole, and from that, we can actually derive a really neat result, this reprocessing I mentioned before. So, for the green function approach, we're going to build a green function. First, we need the homogeneous solutions, which have appropriate boundary conditions. So, for instance, there's one homogeneous solution to the wave equation, which has good boundary conditions at the horizon. There's one that has good boundary conditions at infinity. So, this is only outgoing at infinity. This is only ingoing in the horizon of a black hole. And from these, in the black hole case, we construct a green function with the usual variation of parameters methodology, where it's a sum combination of the two homogeneous solutions divided by some normalizing Wronskian. And this Wronskian is some constant in terms of our radial position, but it's a frequency-dependent thing. In particular, it turns out this Wronskian vanishes in the complex frequency plane, and these poles of the Wronskian, sorry, these zeros of the Wronskian are then poles of the green function. Those poles of the green function are precisely these quasi-neural modes. So that's just a brief review of the green function. Again, we're going to build a radial green function just like we do in Schwarzschild, just like we do when there's a horizon. And we're going to do this now for the reflecting barrier case. So when we've got a reflection now, we are going to build the green function in the same way, build it out of homogeneous solutions to the wave equation, because outside the body, the wave equation hasn't changed. It's just the boundary condition that's changed. So now the green function has to obey a different boundary condition at the position of the surface. It's got to have some reflection from the surface. We can enforce that this green function have such a boundary condition by building it out of these two same homogeneous solutions. And now I've written down what the behavior of one of the two solutions is near the horizon. It's got both an ingoing and an outgoing piece. The other one just has an ingoing piece. By a linear combination of this ingoing and this solution, which has both in and outgoing pieces, I can enforce that the green function obey a reflecting boundary condition at the horizon, at the surface of this exotic compact object. And after you do some algebra, you get a really nice result. The response in a spacetime with this reflecting boundary is equal to the response you would have gotten in a black hole spacetime to the same sources, plus some extra modification. This modification is built from the homogeneous solutions, and importantly, there is this transfer function sitting here, which itself is made out of some reflection and transmission and the reflection of the barrier. And I'll unpack this in a diagram now because it's a little hard to parse what it's doing. But before I unpack this transmission function, the power of this is that if I have some source, if I have some source and I integrate that source to get a response using the green function, one piece of this looks exactly like the black hole case I would have gotten, and one piece is closely related to the black hole case except for this transfer function. So the amplitude of waves at infinity I'm going to call z. If I have some source that moves through the spacetime, any source at all, and I calculate what the amplitude of waves are far from the compact object, I'm going to find that from that first piece of the green function, I get exactly the same emission I would normally get from a black hole, quasi-neural mode ringing and all. And then I'm going to add to that an extra piece, which has a very easy to understand physical interpretation. This is the amplitude of waves impinging on the horizon of the black hole. Right? So this source is generating waves. Some of them go straight to infinity. Some of them are going to try to go down to the black hole. But since I've replaced the black hole with a reflecting barrier, they're going to get reprocessed in a complicated way instead of leaving the spacetime. And they're going to arrive at infinity after this reprocessing. So provided I know how to calculate the amplitude of waves at infinity and the amplitude of waves at the horizon for any given source in a black hole spacetime, if you give me your favorite reflectivity, I can tell you what the echoes look like just using this formula. We can look at this transfer function in two ways. Like I said, it's got this form here, where it's a combination of transmission through the barrier, reflection. There's this This term here gives you some time delay by propagation. It's kind of hard to parse this, but what's really nice is if you expand the denominator using a geometric series, you just get a sum of terms. And the sum of terms now can actually be understood, like I said, diagrammatically. So what happens with this sum of terms? Well, if we have some thing emitting waves here, some of the waves go straight out to Scribe Plus, and they form a prompt signal, which is your usual burst from some kind of gravitational wave event. And some of the signal now is going to propagate and try to go through the black hole horizon. But instead, it's going to hit this barrier, and it's going to bounce. And when it bounces, it gets one factor of reflection. It's now going to hit the black hole scattering peak. And remember, the black hole scattering peak is the other side of this cavity. Some of that wave gets transmitted. That'll give you a factor of transmission. And then it'll reach infinity. And that's the first term in this sum, the waves which bounce once and transmit. But some of it will be reflected. And that gets an extra term of reflection. They'll hit the barrier, they'll hit the boundary again, they'll reflect once, and then they'll finally transmit and reach infinity. And every time you go through this process of bouncing, you pick up an extra factor of phase delay, which just accounts for the amount of time it takes to bounce off the barrier. Okay? So by writing this as a sum of terms, we see you get an infinite sequence of echoes over and over again. Each successive echo gets an extra factor of reflection from the barrier, an extra factor of reflection from the black hole's own scattering potential. Okay? Yes?
So I'm confused by something. So what chooses the origin of x? Or how do you decide the origin of x? Because it looks like the time delay between the echoes is, I guess, 2x naught.
So that's a good question. So you can always choose the origin of x differently. You pick an origin. It turns out that because the r and the t are defined as the asymptotic amplitudes of scattering and reflection, if you shift the origin in x, you add an additional phase factor to this of precisely this kind of form. And so this formula is actually invariant under shifting the origin of x.
I see. So whatever shift, it can be absorbed in r.
Yeah, it automatically just redefines your phase definition on r and t. So it's very important when you do practical calculations to choose an origin for your tortoise coordinate and use it once and for all. But you can show that by changing that, you don't change the signal. Okay.
Okay, perhaps one equal to x minus x naught is infinitesimal.
Yeah, so in this picture, the distance in Schwarzschild coordinates between the horizon and this surface is infinitesimal, right? And what that does is that'll make this x naught here something like 50 m, or maybe I think by 70 or so m, you're already at the Planck length away from the horizon. So so this in principle could be an infinitesimal distance between these two things. Any other questions? This is sort of the main picture here. And from here, I probably need to speed up and go through the results, unfortunately. But this is what needs to be understood, I think. OK. So once you understand this, what you realize is that the whole understanding of what these echoes look like is determined by the transfer function. Right? So here's what the transfer function looks like. When you first transmit through the barrier, what you find is that you get this factor of t, which is this blue dotted line here. And notice that this is a high-pass filter. The waves with low frequencies are not transmitted well out of this cavity, so they remain in the cavity. And only higher frequency waves make it through on the first pass. On the second pass, you get a factor of the reflection, too. And the reflection is the opposite. It's a low-pass filter. And so the two of them together form a bandpass filter. And it turns out that this bandpass filter is centered on the quasi-neural mode frequencies of the black hole. Okay? So after the first pass, where you lose the low frequency stuff, every successive echo has essentially been bandpass filtered to select out frequencies very close to the quasi-neural mode frequencies. This means that the successive echoes are all going to oscillate at about the quasi-neural mode frequency. Okay? It turns out that as I continue to multiply over and over again by r, since r has this characteristic shape, it begins to pull the bandpass filter to slightly lower frequencies, but over time, this doesn't change very much on successive multiplications, and so the later echoes don't change this filter too much. This is what this looks like in the time domain. This transfer function in the time domain gives you some wave that you have to convolve your source with. So once again, you sort of have this characteristic oscillation at the quasi-neural mode frequency. And as we go to successively higher and higher numbers of echoes, the appropriate transfer function essentially sort of disperses out. But after 10 or 11 echoes, mostly all that's changing is the phase. The qualitative features, in other words, the length of this transfer function, isn't changing too much.
It kept getting longer, right?
Yeah. So from echo numbers 1 to 10, it keeps getting longer. But beyond 10, it's changing very slowly from successive echo to echo. It still continues to broaden, but it doesn't change as fast.
Arnold, so that's k, that's the 11th or the 10th divided by the r to the 10th.
Yeah, sorry. So this is, so if I'm going to illustrate what the transfer functions look like and I focus on k, we're in a nice situation that where if r is constant, I can divide it out. So most of what I'm going to be talking about is a constant r. I just fix a constant reflectivity. So in other words, if you allowed some of the waves to be absorbed by the black hole, you would have to multiply this by some number less than 1 twice, so it would cut the amplitude. I'd have to do this by that number to the 10th power, so these would be very small. So if the reflectivity is anything less than 1, you also quickly have these echoes vanish. Good question. Thank you for asking. OK, so very quickly, by taking these transfer functions and convolving them with a given signal, you then get your echo prediction. The transfer functions are independent of the source, right? So you can focus on them to understand how all sources would change. But if you want to see what the echoes actually look like, you have to pick your favorite source. So for us, we took a scalar point particle orbiting at the ESCO, and we let it spiral into the black hole in order to generate this particular waveform at the horizon. This is what the waveform looks like at the horizon. There's some chirp, some big peak, because it's a point particle hitting the horizon, and then some ring down. We can take this and actually convolve it with our echoes, and we find, sure enough, as I said, the very first echo is different, because the very first echo is just one factor of transmission. It's not been bandpass filtered, it's just low pass filtered. So this one looks a little bit different than the rest. But after the first echo, the successive echoes look a lot like those echo transfer functions I showed. The actual echo is just something which sort of rings up, rings at approximately the quasi-neural mode frequency, rings down, and each successive echo just sort of broadens out. And once again, in order to actually show this, once again, we have to say, here we're dealing with constant reflectivities, and so I'm dividing out the overall modulation of the amplitude by possible absorption. If I want to then think about what the total signal looks like, these are the individual echoes. As they get longer and longer in time, even though they're time shifted by that delay factor, as they continue to spread out, they begin to interfere with each other. So in order to finally actually sum these into a signal, I have to actually choose a particular x naught to use. That sets the spacing of these things when I add them. And I have to pick a particular reflectivity to use. That sets the amplitude. So if I choose perfect reflecting boundary conditions and I set my barrier very, very close to the horizon, x equals the torus coordinate minus 50m, then this is what the total signal would look like. You get the first burst, you get a series of echoes. The first echo looks a bit different than the rest, and the rest sort of look a little bit distinct, but eventually they blend together as they begin to interfere with each other. And you finally get just sort of a ringing.
So yeah. You think the first echo is the higher amplitude?
In this particular model, the first echo is higher amplitude. But this is going to depend on both the reflectivity and the details of the source. So I think the reason why this one is getting such a high amplitude is, remember, this burst is the waves that would have been emitted to infinity. All of these bursts only depend on the waves that would have hit the horizon. So this is, I think, basically the statement that the amplitude of the horizon wave is rather high in some normalized sense as compared to the waves that would have reached infinity. And for this particular in-spiral, you get, surprisingly to me actually, high first echo, and successive echoes are lower and lower. So actually, you can have a rather dramatic effect here. So I really want to emphasize this. So while it may be hard from just seeing the ring down to determine whether this object has a horizon or not, you know for pretty damn sure, right, that it is not an object that has some perfect reflectivity, because you could, in principle, get quite a loud signal from that. In principle, right? You need to choose your favorite source here and convolve it with these transfer functions. So when the barrier is very close to the horizon, so r minus r naught, it's like 10 to the minus 12 m, you get a few distinct echoes before they blend. If I put the barrier a little further from the horizon, the later echoes stop being quite as distinct. So very quickly, you lose distinct echoes, and you just sort of get a slow decaying ringing.
So Aaron, presumably, at some point, these echoes are dying down because you're using stuff to infinity. What's the time scale for that?
This then is the logarithmic time scale. So basically, when I said that the fun, so is this on the next slide? No, it's two slides. Let me answer your question in two slides. All right, so just as an illustration, you can do something non-trivial. You can use the wormhole. There is a particular prediction for that frequency-dependent reflectivity for the wormhole, and this is what you get for the wormhole. You characteristically get bigger delay factors for the wormhole because you get to travel down into the other universe and reflect back, and so the echoes tend to be more distinct. That's basically what happens with the wormhole.
So, Aaron, on that question, so the SNR of the ring down peaks of the first signal was of the order 7 or 8.
Yes.
So the first echo of that one would have had, what, 2?
I mean, arguing by analogy, I would think that the first echo of that would be pretty distinct, because the ring down in this model is maybe this amount of the waveform, so it could be, I don't know, a fourth? I don't know. By eye, it's hard to say. But it could be a few, yeah.
Just something that could have.
I would not be at all surprised if you could put bounds on a constant reflectivity from the first event.
It's intuitively strange. There's such a tiny difference between the horizon and the reflector.
Yes.
Can cause such a big effect.
Yes.
Well, but it's reflectivity one. That's
well, this is basically all of the energy that would have gone into the horizon slowly leaking out over time. So yeah, it does make a huge qualitative difference. It does defy the intuition a little bit. It's important to, well, I don't think I want to get into some, there's, if you think about energy considerations, there may be some reasons why this isn't so surprising, but maybe I shouldn't get into that. I think this is surprising and is actually the most promising thing about this echo picture, is that if these objects are not black holes, it has pretty dramatic consequences, and this is pretty generic. This is pretty generic.
Why?
Because well, you got to imagine actually that from the perspective of the full waveform, these are little blips, right? If this were a full in spiral, right, there's this really long period of time where all this energy is emitting to infinity, and then finally, this last little bit, as the particle is finally crossing this photon orbit and emitting, half of that, roughly speaking, goes out to infinity. And then the rest of it gets trapped for a long time and reprocessed. Right? And so this is a dramatic thing, but these blips are not so dramatic when you take them into the context of the full waveform.
This will play a role when you try to determine whether experimentally
yes.
you see it.
Yes. So that's what Luis's question was about. If the ring down portion maybe was roughly this, for GW150914, then even under this very severe echo model with a very loud echo, right, this might still be below what you would, it might be marginal for detection purposes.
So what is the reflectivity as a function of omega for the wormhole?
So for the wormhole, it turns out that the reflectivity is 1, but you skip every other echo. So there's a really nice relation. It's the same as this picture, but delete every other echo, basically.
So what's a physical equation?
You double the decay. It's just twice as long, yeah. It's just twice as long.
That plot, sorry, I was going to ask you, so in the previous one, you have R equal 1,
yeah.
R equal 1, there's no difference, right?
Yeah, sorry, this is just it's actually in our paper a mistake, too. Somebody made the plot wrong, I won't say who. You can actually blame probably me for that. I insisted on getting LaTeX into the Mathematica plots, which is kind of painful. So any mistakes that occurred in the plotting is probably, in the end, on me. So this is to answer Will's question. What is the ultimate decay time of the echo as a whole? right? And the way you want to answer this question is you want to take a step back and go back to one of the first things I said about these compact objects. The shape of the scattering potential indicates that instead of having the regular black hole quasineuron modes, which it turns out are not poles of this new Green function, you can show that, you instead should expect these very slowly decaying cavity modes, right? And in fact, you can find them if I set the boundary a little further and do my same reprocessing scheme. Instead of getting all of the echoes nicely spaced, they all blend together and they happen to be nicely in phase. And what you end up with is a very long signal, which is very slowly decaying, which should look a lot like the oscillations of a neutron star, actually, after merger, right? And so the ultimate decay time of this is set by those slowly decaying quasineuron modes. And so in answer to your question, Will, ultimately the final dying out of these echoes is determined by the decay time of the quasineuron modes of the exotic compact object itself. So that's going to be this 1 over log of the distance between the two surfaces. So it's quite long. It can be quite long. OK, I'm well over time, I think. So I'll just go ahead and.
You're just over time.
Well, I've got a few slides, so I'll control myself. Let me see what I want to say here. I totally did not fix this slide. So yeah, so this is just that statement that here is our source. This is the transfer function. Sorry, this is the transfer function. You can see for the particular value of r equals 0.28 that I had here, r equals 2.08, this is what k looks like. And you see that it's got very strongly one pole. And that one pole means that when I put in my in spiral, it excites one oscillation at one particular mode. And so we can understand this particular case as the excitation of one mode, whereas the other cases that I was showing you before, which looked like many echoes, you can understand that by seeing that in this case, the transfer function as a whole has many, 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 many spikes, many poles. When I have an excitation here, I excite many of them. And so those echoes are actually still the quasi-neural modes of the compact object. It's just that you excite a ton of them with a particular phasing. And that phasing makes it look like they come out as bursts. All of these things can be understood in this model that we've developed. OK, so I'll say this last and then finish. You might want to then take all of this stuff I've just said and say to yourself, OK, great. You say you've got a formula for reprocessing a black hole waveform and turning it into an echo waveform, given a particular reflectivity and barrier position. So can I run off and use this in my data analysis? Well, not quite yet. You still need waves on the black hole background, right? And that still can be a complicated thing to do. But remember, I've already said that the transfer function acts as a bandpass filter right around the quasineural mode frequencies. That means that the whole black hole waveform isn't the important thing. What it means is that the most important thing is the power you have in your horizon signal that's centered in this window here. And so we had this idea that we could replace the actual source, so this is the power spectrum of this ESCO plunge source I mentioned, with just a single quasineural mode ringing at the black hole's quasineural mode frequencies, and have a simpler template which could still capture the details of the source, but now has a few free parameters and should basically be able to give you the echo prediction for any kind of source you choose, provided that you maximize over these free parameters. And so then those are your parameterized model for echoes. So what is our model? We have the quasineuron mode ringing start at some time. It's got the usual decay rate. It's made up of the usual positive and negative frequency modes. So this determines the amplitude and phase of your oscillator. And then in order to have the ringing turn on smoothly, we convolve it with a Gaussian. So we've got the Gaussian has some time at which the Gaussian is centered, and it has some width in time. And basically what we're saying is over this Gaussian, we're going to put power into your quasineural mode and then allow it to ring freely.
Sorry, what is the Gaussian? I don't understand.
Oh, this is just the idea that as a particle's falling into a black hole, it doesn't just like turn on the quasineural mode oscillation. The particle can actually be envisioned as something which forces these oscillators into motion. And so there's a period of time over which the particle is passing through the strong gravity region and putting some power into the quasineural modes. Then it gets past that region and it basically stops powering them. So you can't really use a model where the modes just turn on suddenly. You want to use a model where you smoothly turn on the modes and let your particular model of the source determine that turn on time. So this is just an easy way of doing that. We use a Gaussian because we're, of course, going to really do this in the frequency domain. And in the frequency domain, this Gaussian, you know, has a nice, is also a Gaussian. And so in the frequency domain, it's just a Gaussian times two Lorentzians. This is now going to be what we use for our horizon mode. We take this as our source. We convolve it with our transfer functions. And that gives us our echoes. And what we did is we tried to find out, if I maximize the overlap of this model over my four model parameters, these are two complex parameters, so there's slightly more parameters there, how good can I do against the full signal I mentioned earlier, this whole thing where I use the entire source, right? And this is the answer. For a given position of the barrier over a range of reflectivities, by tuning our parameters of the ring down, we can actually match the echo signal, the full echo signal from our entire plunge, with a really good match. This matches, this overlap is greater than 96% for almost all values of R. We do have some trouble when R goes to 1, this degrades rapidly. That's because, as I pointed out to you before, when R is 1 and the barrier is close to the black hole, there's a lot of resonances in the transfer function at low frequencies. And so the low frequency content, which we totally miss, we completely miss the low frequency content in this replacement of the source, that low frequency content is important. So that's why you get some degradation here. But for slightly smaller reflectivities, this is a pretty good model. And so our
When the barrier gets close, why does it
match
get better?
Because when the barrier is close enough, you're just exciting one mode of the object. That mode happens to have a frequency close to the quasi-zero mode frequency, just a slow decay rate. So you're still getting power right where you need it. Good question. Okay, so I think that's all I have to say about our model. So the message of this is we have an algorithm for reprocessing black hole waveforms into echoes given a parameterized model of your favorite compact object. It can perform, we have a template to replace a given source, which for the source we tested performs really well. So this may be useful in data analysis. But this is really not a very good picture. So I'm going to have to speed super fast through this. This was for scalar fields on Schwarzschild. So we have to relax a few assumptions. The next thing we have to do is we have to let these black holes spin. This is, in principle, just a technical challenge. It's not a conceptual challenge. But it does introduce some interesting extra physics, which maybe you think about and consider. But basically, this is straightforward. In fact, Niyash and his student have already basically worked through this. More difficult is to not do scalar fields, but do gravitational waves. The reason for that, I don't have time to go into it, but it's because in order to fix boundary conditions on the gravitational waves, you actually have to fix boundary conditions on multiple different scalar fields, which represent the different ingoing and outgoing parts of the gravitational wave. So while our boundary conditions were very simple for scalar waves, for gravitational waves or for electromagnetic waves, the situation is more complicated, as pointed out in this paper by Price and Khanna this year, where they talked about the electromagnetic case very specifically and showed that you need to have conditions on two entirely different fields, one representing ingoing electromagnetic waves, one representing outgoing electromagnetic waves, in order to actually have boundary conditions at the object that are reflecting boundary conditions. So this has not yet been done for gravitational waves, and it may end up being a complicating technical challenge. So this is work for the future. Finally, the ultimate question. This is really important, so I will take a moment on this. To date, all of the stuff I've talked about on echoes, every echo we've ever seen, is a result for a test field on a fixed background. Well, when I take two black holes and I collide them, this is not a test field on a fixed background. This is a fully nonlinear system. So in order to do this properly, I need a full model for your non-black hole object. You need to have these crash together, and you need to see if the ring down of that thing actually produces echoes. This is a huge caveat to everything I've just said and all the modeling I just talked about. The only time this has been done, to my knowledge so far, has been in boson-star collisions, right? For sufficiently compact boson stars, you can actually have these things look like black holes. You can collide them numerically. This is their emission in gravitational waves. Looks nothing like what I've been talking about. Much messier. So there is no demonstrated case where you get clean echoes from a more comparable mass system.
But most of the cells are not very compact.
These are sufficiently compact. These are a middle ground, actually. They're compact enough that the final object doesn't collapse to a black hole.
But that's my point, is there's a limit because of that.
Yeah. So boson stars aren't the perfect case study, but they're the only thing that's been done so far, which is a black hole mimicker, to my knowledge. Please correct me if I'm wrong. And they do not produce an echo. So this is the hard work that someone needs to take on if we're really interested in understanding how the gravitational wave emission from non-black hole objects differs from that of black holes. So I'll just go ahead and conclude here. And thanks very much, everyone, for sticking around.
So Aaron will be here all day, and then he'll be here for PubMed as well. So any questions for Aaron? John?
Something I'm misunderstanding. When you increase epsilon, X minus yeah. X naught comes of order 1.
Yes.
It quenches the.
Yes, completely.
So then, therefore, it looks like a black hole, but it isn't.
No, so in that case, it doesn't even look like a black hole. So the reason why you get quasi-normal ringing again is because we have the scattering barrier, and the peak of the scattering barrier is at about 3m. It's actually slightly inside 3m. And if I take this surface progressively further out, of course, I erase this potential. It does something different inside the body. If I finally take this thing out here, I don't even have a peak to this scattering potential anymore. This object no longer supports quasi-normal ringing. So it will not even mimic a black hole. Right? The worry here was that a very compact object could mimic a black hole, and you could get a ring down that looked like a black hole, but it wasn't a black hole. For this kind of object, this would be like a neutron star, right? Compact neutron stars can be almost this compact. They don't support a light ring, they don't support quasi-normal modes, but they have their own modes of motion, right? The F mode of the overall shape of the neutron star. And in those cases, you get a completely different spectrum than a ring down. Just like one of the slides I showed, in a neutron star merger, you get a very long-lived, complicated oscillation at the modes of the star. And this looks nothing like a ring down from a black hole. You would tell right away if you'd seen that.
So the data already says that it can't be.
The data already, yes. So the data definitively could be used to put a bound on the position of this supposed surface. It's definitely inside 3M because we saw something consistent with ringing. But where this surface is restricted to be from the data is a question for observations. This now becomes your test, right?
How many events do you need?
Well, the first event already told you this much. That first event was very lucky. I think in many ways, if you're clever, you can combine the events statistically to put bounds which grow with square root n, provided the events all have similar noise. So if we want to say that, for instance, the first event tells us the barrier was outside of epsilon equals whatever, it's going to take 10 more events to shrink that by square root 10 and 100 to shrink it by a factor of 10. And that's only if the events are comparable in size and you're clever about how you combine them.
So the first event already excludes epsilon 1.
Yeah, the first event is the most powerful discriminator and it's already done most of the work that you're going to get. Yeah.
How degenerate is the conclusion over two knobs you have, location and reflection?
I think probably the quasi-neural mode signal you saw in the first place is the strongest discriminator for the position in this gross sense. Because if the position is too far out, you really probably start to deform the quasi-neural mode signal into something that looks like a neutron star, right? And
sure.
And
can I know at some point?
Well, so remember, R of omega can be frequency dependent. So of course, I could probably engineer it to give you whatever you want. But that's why you probably want to do a study of a few compact objects that are reasonable in order to sketch out a reasonable functional form for R of omega. But yeah, I would bet that the position X naught for one thing, X naught and R are degenerate in the sense that when X naught's at least close to the horizon, the most definitive signature of the position of this surface is in the time delay between the echoes. So you measure that and you might think I've measured X naught. But that's not true, right? Because if I engineer the surface to add some additional delay factor, you would have that be degenerate with X naught. So there's no question that X naught, when you're close to the horizon, is degenerate with the phase factor that the barrier inject, completely degenerate. But in terms of an X naught which is large enough that you really start to deform the wave properties, that's already probably been ruled out. Yeah. So beyond that, totally degenerate.
Can we just check something? So like in the boson star case you're talking about, I mean, in that case, you know, even if you make it very compact, what's presumably happening is not that the gravitational waves are reflecting off the surface of the star, but just passing right through and coming out the other side.
Yes.
Right? Does that make no change here?
Yeah. So the point of the formalism is to say that from the perspective of the radial wave function, waves passing through the center of the boson star, what you solve the radial wave equation, you just solve it with the regularity condition at the origin, and some details of this potential, so also some phase delay and some amplitude modification, you can always replace that with some arbitrary functional form of the reflectivity here. It's actually, so long as this is a test field, it's very straightforward to see that. If this is not a test field, that totally doesn't work. If the boson star itself is now in motion, that's not going to be the case anymore, right?
Yeah, but it's still, as long as you have linearized response, it's like a dielectric or whatever you want to call it.
Well, if it's linear, that's probably true. I'm worried about if this thing is in motion, it should be generating waves. So you need to have some kind of reflectivity here, which also emits more energy than was coming in, right? Or could spontaneously emit energy. And that's maybe something you wouldn't want to put down, right? If the boson star material was actually moving. But yes,
even if the material is moving, as long as it's linear, you could just...
You would write this as something which puts out energy, right? Because you have to have energy come out of the boson star in that case. Yeah.
So on one of the slides you flipped through at the end, you were saying something about super radiant instability when you try and...
Yeah, this was this other study. So I've actually learned a lot more about this today in conversation with people here. But one thing to point out is that whenever you have one of these compact objects in the past, it's been found that if that compact object is rotating sufficiently fast, there's a super radiant instability. Basically, if that object has an ergosphere, then you can produce positive energy and negative energy modes in that ergosphere spontaneously and have a runaway instability where you are emitting more and more energy and slowing down the object. So similarly, if I'm going to be able to replace this compact object with a reflecting barrier, what that means is that you would think that if I put a reflecting barrier on a Kerr spacetime, it should be super radiantly unstable. And it is. If you plot the imaginary part of the quasi-remote frequency versus A for a perfectly reflecting barrier, you see that for a high enough spin, the decay rate changes sign, and you actually have an exponentially growing mode. What this paper showed was that very small amounts of absorption in that barrier actually cut off that super radiant instability. So they found that the super radiant instability was very sensitive to how much absorption was in the object. Yeah.
And to the boson star case, intuitively it seems puzzling that it, like, so again, we have, imagine we have our boson star that's slightly bigger than a black hole.
Yeah.
It seems like there should be two time scales, one for the echoes that bounce off the surface and come out, and the other ones for the echoes that bounce off the origin.
So in a boson star, particularly when you're thinking about this test field limit, the first one, the waves that reflect off the surface, that doesn't exist, right? What you're really doing is you're replacing this picture. Waves come in, they enter the boson star, maybe they rattle around or do something, or they're just slowed down by the gravitational potential, and then they come out transformed in some way. You're just replacing that process by a frequency-dependent reflectivity, which in the time domain means, right, you could actually have time delays and dispersion and anything you want. So that effect of propagation through the boson star has been replaced with the reflecting boundary condition itself. And that can account for any amount of partial reflection, right? If some of it comes right out and some of it comes out later, that can all be encoded in this some kind of scrambling by the frequency dependence.
I think Lentham is right. I mean, you could have surface reflection.
You could also have surface reflection, but I think you could, as long as you said it's linear, you incorporate that into some kind of dispersion here.
That's right. I agree.
Yeah.
I think the problem with boson stars or neutron stars is that you're talking about frequencies that are comparable to all the other times. There is no hierarchy of scales.
Yeah.
So everything is just mixes together.
Yeah. And you're also talking about gravitational waves, which are dynamically kind of significant, right? So, I mean, this whole picture really in the comparable mass case, you're not thinking about an object and a little object, and this is going around and emitting, and some of these waves are bouncing off the surface and reaching us, right? That would give you echoes. We're talking about smashing two exotic objects together, and they're going to do something dynamic. Who knows if that leads to a ring down state, where you have a final object kind of clothed in some perturbations, which will be inside the scattering barrier and therefore produce echoes. That would be the way to get echoes, is if the final state of the object really was approximately the object clothed in some perturbations that would leak out very slowly after many successive passages. That seems kind of unlikely to me, but at least in the extreme mass limit, you should recover the echoes. So if supermassive black holes are exotic objects and I throw in a little black hole, you might expect to see echoes in that case. For example, yeah.
So I think maybe in view of time, it's like maybe we should thank Aaron.
Thanks.